Hello, everyone and everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, December 30th, 2018. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart? You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 235. Super special guest, actor James Vincent Meredith, who you can currently see in the latest Steve McQueen film, Widows. It's great. He's great. Going to share that conversation with you in a bit. Now I'm just going to talk to you. So I'm in my apartment and I've got YouTube on mute. John Krasinski is, I guess he's talking about A Quiet Place. It's for the SAG-AFTRA Foundation. It's a good YouTube channel if you like actor interviews, actor director, writer interviews and stuff like that. It's really good. I recommend the Steve McQueen SAG-AFTRA Foundation. It's really good, and it's very black in a way that it was unexpectedly. I was like listening to it. I was listening to it at work. And I was like, oh shit. You know, I was just like, oh, okay, Steve, I didn't know you was going to take it there, but I'm glad that you did, and I appreciate it. It's really good. I started my morning off by watching Bill Duke talk about, I just kind of went down a Bill Duke rabbit hole, and he was talking about coming up in the industry, and then if you just kind of let it play, YouTube will do like random stuff, and it eventually got to John Krasinski. He's on mute. I gotta watch A Quiet Place again after this Bird Box shit, because everybody's like, oh, it's like Bird Box is like A Quiet Place. You can't see anything. Quiet Place, you couldn't make a sound. This one, you can't look at anything. Bird Box was all right, you know, but I think Black Twitter is just making it a phenomenon. I think it's an okay movie. I was like, yeah. I like Sandra Bullock. I like Trevante. You know, I like, you know, it's fine. And it's a neat little thing, you know, when Netflix, last year they did Bright, and people panned that one. But so many people watching it. Anyway. But I bought A Quiet Place from Redbox for like $4. And I liked it when I saw it. Maranzio Vance and I did a review on the Patreon, and we talked about that. But I just want to see it again. And it's like they say it might get some awards, might get nominated for an Oscar or two. So we'll see. I hope everybody had. So basically, okay, look, so the pod has been away. I've been off for a couple weeks. I've just been really busy with work and other stuff, and I'm back, and just back with another episode. I hope everybody had a great holiday, Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate. There's no judgment here. I want all of your ears. I don't care if they're black ears, Jewish ears, Asian ears, white ears, Latino ears, did I say black and white too many? I don't know. I don't care what color your ears are. I like you listening to the pod. How about that, guys? Huh? Guys and gals, you know? How about that, you know? I hope it was fun. I had a good one. I spent Christmas with my parents, and it was cool. My dad and I watched The Equalizer 2. I bought him that for Christmas. And he enjoyed that. And what else? Oh, my mom was. I found out that my mom's been holding out on me because Christmas Eve, she just got in her head that she wanted to make Reubens, grilled Reuben sandwiches, and they were fucking incredible. They were great, but then I kind of got a little angry with her because she had never made throughout my. I'm almost 40. I'll be 39 in February, and she never made one for me. Now, in her defense, I was a finicky eater when I was a little kid, but I grew out of that shit. I think by the time you're like a teenager, you kind of grow out of that, and especially when you go away to college, you do grow out of that shit. But she'd never made them for me before. And I was like, oh my God, Mom, this is incredible. She was just like, well, you know, I've been making them for like 40 years. And I'm like, what? And you still, she's been holding out on me. And I would say that that's my favorite dish of hers. I would say that it used to be spaghetti, but I've since surpassed her about 10 years ago. Like I've gotten much better than her at making spaghetti. So I've passed her at that. She basically taught me how to make an omelet. Or I think she was the first person to make me an omelet at home. Like first omelet that I had not made by somebody at a restaurant. And she was good at that. And I remember, I think it might have been summer or spring of this year or last year when I made them omelets, because we had gotten a honey baked ham and I made them omelets before I left, and they liked that. So that was good. So I make really good spaghetti. I make really good omelets. And yeah, I'm pretty good at that. Ladies, I'm good at making salmon too. I got to get some salmon. So I'm good at that. I have, you know, I'm pretty good. I'm good at making salmon. Yeah. So that was fun. And then Wednesday night, well, as I was driving home on Wednesday, driving up from Maryland, I got a message from the owner at Gotham, one of the owners at Gotham, to do this show, Gotham Comedy Live, which is basically like this Gotham Comedy All-Stars. And you do it, you basically just do a 10-minute set, and if you subscribe to Oculus, you know, if you've seen that commercial with Jonah Hill and Adam Levine and Jonah Hill are doing this commercial where they both have Oculus, and it's like they're watching a Golden State Warriors game, and it's like they're in the crowd. So if you have that and you have the app and you can look at it and you can like watch the comedy show like you're like there. So that was pretty neat. And I did that show. It was super fun. And went to work the next day. And then I had another show in Pleasantville at Lucy's Laughs. That was fun. That was real fun. Got to close out the show and do some time, fuck around a little bit, worked on a couple new bits. One of the audience members remembered a bit of mine, and he was like, oh, I remember that bit. You changed some stuff up in your set, but I do remember that blah, blah, blah bit that you had. I was like, oh, yeah, I did. Like, I'm working on an album. You know, so I'm working on shit. So I worked on some new stuff. And so I had a good week. I had a fun week, and yesterday I went Saturday, which would have been Saturday. I said, you know what? I'm going to get myself a ticket to see a Broadway play. And I went to go see American Son, starring Kerry Washington. And it's currently on Broadway, running through January 27th. I highly recommend it. If you just want to see like a television star, like do her thing. Like I've always been a fan of Kerry Washington. Ever since she came on my radar with Save the Last Dance. And I watched Scandal, but I bailed. But it wasn't because the show's bad. It's just like, she's great, you know, whatever. But she fucking this play, American Son, it's 90 minutes of Kerry Washington just fucking flexing. And she's a monster. Like this, it's a play about, she's a monster on stage. It's a play about a mother who is at a police station, and she's there because she's worried about her 18-year-old son that hasn't come home, and her son is biracial, and it basically some shit goes down, and it's 90 minutes of that, and it's like a meditation on race, gender, a little bit of gender stuff. Yeah, it's some gender stuff in there. Police brutality, all this shit rolled into one. Yeah, it's really fucking good. And I was front row. I had orchestra seats. I was just like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to get an orchestra seat and just sit there. But the thing about these theaters on Broadway, like you pay so much money for these tickets, and you're sitting in this like tight space, and these two women were sitting in the same row as me, and there was a seat in between us, but it was at, so thankfully nobody else showed up. But my God, like it was just, I was just right up there, and it's just still kind of tight. But thankfully the play was just 90 minutes, and it wasn't bad at all, but it was so great. And then after that, I went to go see the Nicole Kidman movie, Destroyer. And which was good. I think Nicole Kidman will probably get nominated for that. I would say I'm supposed to be doing an end of the year pod. So that's going to probably be out next week. Like movies, top crap and all that stuff. Like the nerds do, you know, so there'll be some nerd shit for you on the next podcast. But what I did was, so if you guys have listened to the show, if you know me, you know that I love movies, and I've embraced being a theater snob, as far as like movie theater snob and like how nice a theater is and blah, blah, blah. I think the best theater in New York City, in Manhattan proper, that I've been to is the Landmark on 57th. It's on West 57th. It's right by the Hudson, the 9A, West Side Highway. And it's really nice, really good seats, really nice theater. It's clean, all this stuff. Tickets cost $20, basically. So what I did was I was like, okay, I want to see this play, and I went to a matinee. So I was like, okay, the show will be over at about 3, show's at 2, be over around 3:30. The walk from, they say it's a 30-minute walk, but it didn't feel like a 30-minute walk. So I was just like, you know what? I need the exercise. I'm just going to park at this Landmark Theater because it's $20 for like 7 or 8 hours. It's really cheap. If you park on the West Side Highway, it's pretty cheap, and you just walk to wherever else you're going. Like it's perfect. I think I'm going to do that the next time I have something. And the next time I'm doing something leisurely, like seeing a play, if I'm by myself. But that was a nice walk. And I was listening to I was listening to music on my phone, had a nice walk. And, so I was like, cool, I'll do that. And that there was a screening of Destroyer at 5:00. So, after the show, I walked back to, the Landmark on 57th, and it was like a fucking nightclub. Normally, like the old man in me, I like going to the movies early, but because I went to see a play, you know, I'm at the movies at like 5:00. There was nowhere to sit except if you went to the bar. There's a nice bar in the theater, and then there's other restaurants on that strip. And it was a lot. It was just like people just. It's just people. It was just a lot of people. I was just like, okay, you guys, come on. I just want to see this movie. Stop being in my way. That's just me being a selfish asshole. But it was really nice. But that's just me being like reclusive. So, you know, I really like that theater, and I use my movie pass. But this is the thing. This is what I'm not understanding about what movie pass is doing. I know a lot of people jump ship, but I was thinking like, okay, I know that sometimes I like going to these art house theaters, these small theaters. I tried to go. I went to see Ben Is Back on Wednesday at a Bowtie Cinema in, I guess you could call that Hartsdale, New York, which is in Westchester. And I was like, okay, I'll see Ben Is Back. I'll use my movie pass. And it wouldn't let me use it. The app wouldn't let me use it. And a month earlier, I tried to go see Wreck-It Ralph, whatever, Ralph Breaks the Internet, and it wouldn't let me do it. But I was thinking, okay, maybe this at the time the movie had just come out. So maybe I know they do that weird thing like they did initially with the Mission Impossible. I was like, all right. And then so I had to pay $13 to see Ben Is Back, which was solid movie. And then, like, you know, I was like, do I really need Movie Pass? And I'm thinking, okay, if because I can use it at the Landmark, the tickets are like $20. They're $18. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I just need to go. If I go to the Landmark once a month, I've already paid for Movie Pass since it's $9.99. And I think Landmark has a deal or they have some type of ownership with Movie Pass, so that way it works and you can see a brand new movie at a really nice theater for your $9.99 subscription. But so I think the saving grace of me keeping MoviePass was my experience at the Landmark yesterday. Cause I'd seen The Old Man. I've seen like three movies there. The Old Man and the Gun, Can You Ever Forgive Me? And now Destroyer. And I was like, okay, if I just have something to do in the city, I can go to the movie theater there and not have to worry about it. But yeah, it just pisses me off that MoviePass keeps doing this stuff. And maybe I should have bailed. I don't know. But I think I'll keep it for now. So I want to read an email. I got an email from Ka last month. And I did not know that I had it because I got a new phone and I didn't connect my podcast excuse me, email to my phone. So I was like, oh shit, there's an email from late November. So I'm gonna read this email from Ka and we'll talk about it. Hey Chris, as a Chinese American, I really loved the episode with Jen Kwok. Admittedly, I was turned off by woke Asians' Twitter response to Crazy Rich Asians, but after hearing your takes on it, I will give it a shot. I know a couple of problematic faves as well, so I relate to your reactions during the Maranzio Vance conversation. Maranzio was on a Patreon episode recently, maybe last month. Also, I'm annoyed that you got me saving for a PS4 so I can play The Last of Us 2. I played the original on PS3. Lastly, have you tried The Walking Dead games by Telltale? Rod does the best recaps on that show, but you don't need to follow that series to enjoy the games. The premise is similar to The Last of Us, but the gameplay is simpler, and there is a hashtag black protagonist. As someone who does not have kids, I went through that series last year and cried even harder than I did for Ellie in The Last of Us. Love the podcast as always, Ka. Well, thank you, Ka, for emailing me. You do not have to do what you wrote in the off mic thing. That's very kind of you. You do not have to do that. Hey, man. It's not my fault. If you've seen about you saving for a PS4, I too was like you. I would say in 2014, actually the first time Fonte did the show. Shout out to Fonte, who just celebrated his 40th birthday. Shout out to that man for making the best album of 2014 of 2018 in any genre. How about that? No news is good news. The first time Fonte did the show, it was 2015. It was New Year's. We actually recorded that on New Year's Day, and I went to his place at the time in Raleigh, and he had the last half hour. I was like, oh, we were wrapping the podcast up, and I was like, oh, you got a PS4? And then I always ask people about The Last of Us, and he was like, oh shit. Then we talked like another half hour, and then and he showed me some games on the PS4. I was like, fuck, man, I just got a car, I don't know. And then that was one of the things that pushed me over the edge. And then I eventually got one, a PS4, about a month later. And it's great, man. If you're a gamer, it's worth it. I was just talking to Andy Klein about it. Hold on a second. Okay, sorry about that, folks. Had a Amazon delivery. They're taking over, guys. Amazon's delivering on Sunday. You know, and I know everybody's bitching and complaining about like Arlington, Virginia, and Astoria. They're opening up these locations in Astoria, but and they're like, people are just, oh my god, it's crazy. That we'll see what happens. But I was driving down 95, and like I forget what town it was. I forget what exit. I think it might have been before or after exit 9. Off the off 95. What is that? Is that Garden State? Maybe exit. I don't know. But it's South Jersey, and I saw this huge Amazon facility. It was massive. Nobody talked about that. I don't know if that's new or if that's been there, but that's a huge. That's another huge Amazon location. Anyway, so when we were talking, so where did I leave off? So like I saw Fonte play, he was just playing some game. He was playing this, showed me this game called Flower. And that was pretty cool. It was like an independent game. Look it up. It's like a beautiful game. I was like, Jesus Christ, this looks amazing. And so about a month later, I ended up getting one, and, I think did, no, that was 20. Okay. So yeah, I got one. And Andy Klein and I were talking about this last week, how, you know, if you don't play anymore, it's not worth getting. But I like my PlayStation. I use it to watch Netflix. I use it to watch YouTube. I play games. I just finished Spider-Man. I think I told you guys that. And I'm getting back into Tomb Raider. I'm kind of in it now. Tomb Raider, it's good. I like it. I think Horizon Zero, they borrowed a lot from Horizon Zero Dawn, and I'm assuming the Witcher and all that, it's become more of like you doing these little side quests for people. All games kind of have that now. As far as the character-driven third-person games, for the most part, they have some aspect of that, but it's really fun. I love Tomb Raider, but I fucking hate puzzles. I like jumping and all that shit and climbing. There's no, like, people say that, oh, you know, Tomb Raider borrowed shit from Uncharted and blah, 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 and this and that. But I look at this, like, I played Uncharted, and I was really intense playing that, like, all the way through, like, earlier this year or last year, whenever it was that I beat it. And it's nowhere nearly as, it's not as intense as Tomb Raider, because Tomb Raider, it's not on the same level, like, the just character wise. I'm not saying that Naughty Dog is better than Eidos. I'm just talking about the character. Anyway, it's just more of an intense game, and more of a it's just more drama. So yeah, if you don't, if you, I mean, if you, I'm sure you've seen The Last of Us 2 trailer. So I, yeah, man, like that game is just, that game is basically going to be the swan song for PlayStation. Just like, the original was for PS3. They keep saying in that game, I think it's called Death Stranding or that game, or, the Last of Us game that meets, what's that biker show? You know what I'm talking about? Sons of Anarchy, whatever that game is that they keep delaying and all that stuff. I don't know. But don't blame me, buddy. Blame Naughty Dog. I'm just so backlogged on these games. I just downloaded last week the, what is the game that I've been wanting to play for like 2 years? The Last Guardian, because it was on sale. It was on sale at the PlayStation store for like $11. So that's why I got that. I downloaded that, but I'm not going to play it until after I beat Tomb Raider. And a lot of people just say like, oh, you know, I don't play games that much. So, cause I write, I have to write and I do comedy, whatever, man. It's, I don't know what it, they just try to make it sound like they're better than you. Cause they don't play video games, but I love them. You find the game that's right for you. And if you enjoy it, then so be it. All right. And you can still get stuff done. I've beaten video games. I have a job. I have two jobs. I do comedy. I act. I find time. But there's just a time where you just sort of lock in, when you know you don't have anything else to do, and you just invest in a video game for a couple hours. It's fun. It gets your mind off shit. I would not judge you if you don't play, or if you do play. How about that? But thanks, Cod. Thanks for the email. And like I said, we got a really fun episode coming up that we're going to record this week, and I'm excited about, and the guests are excited about. So without further ado, let's just get you to James Vincent Meredith. I've talked so much. James, I met James in 2002 at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. If you're a listener of this podcast, a regular listener, you know that I always talk about Chicago Shakes and Skokie and Summer on Broadway and all that stuff. James was the was in Julius Caesar, phenomenal actor. He's in the ensemble at Steppenwolf Theater Company, which is a big deal, which is one of the top regional theater companies in the country. He's an incredible actor. And this basically completes the triumvirate of the black actors who was in that production of Julius Caesar. We first had Kimberly Abair Gregory, Aaron Todd Douglas, and now James Vincent Meredith, the three examples who are basically three examples of people that showed me that you can have a career. You can have a career as an actor and have families and live a good life. And so I'm happy to bring you my conversation with the great James Vincent Meredith. Enjoy it, folks. So did you get your bourbon?
No, I got a little beer, though. I think my wife got a Trader Joe's, like, you know, some like cranberry ale or something like that. So that'll have to do the trick for now.
Okay. Well, I have a Mexican Coke, so I mean, I'm.
Oh, gonna, well, there you go. So you're going to be that. Going like 100 miles an hour then with that.
I guess so. Hopefully it doesn't keep me up tonight. But I will say, though, some of those like fruity beers are pretty good. You could kind of turn your nose up at them.
But, yeah, you know, don't hate on them, because they're, yeah. You know, now, but again, this is coming from somebody who used to like drink wine coolers. So, you know. So, you know, you know what I mean? I like it, but I like a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
One thing I won't drink is Moscato. That I won't drink.
Okay. They do say that's a woman's drink, so they say.
Well, I'm not saying all that, but I'm just saying.
You know what, though? One time there was, what was it? Amaretto sour. I'm not a. They say that there was one comedian or something talking about amaretto sour, that it was like a girl's drink. And I was like, they're pretty good, though.
Right.
Somebody ordered one, and I said, oh, I'll take one. Because I'm not a drinker. But if there's something I like, now the next time I go to a bar, I might. No, I don't know if they'll.
No, don't do it. Don't do it, man. Don't do it.
I'll get in trouble. I won't be man enough.
We can talk about all this on the podcast. That's fine with me. I'm all about drinks.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't care.
I like, you know, like that seasonal stuff. Like I mean, because when I didn't start drinking until I moved to Chicago.
I used to like, there was what's the Boston one, Sam Adams? They used to make a cranberry lambic. They probably still make it. Uh-huh. And I remember back like in my mid to late 20s, I was like, man, that's the stuff, man. You got to get yourself on some, you got to get some Sam Adams cherry lambic, because that's real beer, you know, and it's just like, I was drinking cherry juice, basically.
That's hilarious. The first time, like, because when we were doing, when I was doing Julius Caesar with you guys at Chicago Shakes, mm-hmm. I remember one time we went out for my birthday. I don't know if you were there, but it was like we went to Hooters. And it was like my 23rd birthday, and somebody gave me a beer, and it was a Killian's, and I liked that.
Man, Killian's. Whatever happened to Killian's?
It's still around, but it's just kind of like I rarely see it on tap, and sometimes you have to go to the liquor store to get it. Like it's
like that clearly Canadian. You remember that water that was like, it was like it basically was sugar water, but you know, because it was clearly Canadian, people thought it was like really healthy. Do you remember that stuff?
No.
Clearly Canadian. It wasn't alcoholic. It was like LaCroix. Okay. You know, but much sweeter.
Okay.
But because it was clear, you thought you were drinking something healthy, but it was pretty bad stuff.
No, I just I remember Coke Zero and sure. Like the what was it? Crystal Pepsi was the one that was.
Yeah, one of those was clear too. Right. Yeah. Like you were drinking water that was flavored like, but you know, there's something about something being clear that makes you think it's healthy.
Yeah, like Sprite. Or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, I never like, and then I kind of would do. I was talking to somebody about this today, actually. Just beer, like I like the Red Stripe. I'll go with a Heineken, Blue Moon.
Sure.
Go ahead.
There's this Allagash stuff. Have you heard that Allagash?
No,
that's another brand I like. Okay. It's one of those that you spend like, you know, $12 at Whole Foods, and it's you only get four of them. Oh. So, like, you're really getting screwed, but, you know, you're like, it must be really good because there's only four of them. There's not six, you know, it's got to be really top shelf stuff, and it's, you know, just beer.
That's true, though. Like, you think you're doing something because you're in Whole Foods, and it's...
You know what I mean? Now, Amazon's there now, so it's like, how special do you feel, you know?
Yeah. Amazon. You can't like that. I would still, even if I got to a level of fame where I still wouldn't buy all my groceries there.
No,
just like I like their meat, and every now their hot food bar's pretty good though.
But man, they got this like cherry juice. Have you had that cherry thing? It's like, okay, no. I got to think about cherries, man. Now we talked about the cherry beer and all that. So they've got this. Cherry, it's like a cherry concentrate.
Okay.
And man, that chuck, man, you put in like in a cup, and it's like you put in one part, and then you put like seven parts of water in there, and you're done. Like you are set. So like if you like cherry juice, I guess I'm going off on a tangent. If you like cherry juice, man, that's the way to go. It's like a concentrated cherry thing. That's one thing I will say that Whole Foods has that I've not found anywhere else.
Okay.
All right. I'm gonna step off my Whole Foods soapbox.
It's all right. I talk about that sometimes too. I mean, I'm really impressed by Whole Foods. To me, has really great tuna salad. Mm-hmm. Just like your plain plain Jane, run of the mill, like just a solid tuna salad. I like.
They got the one with the cranberries in it.
They do have that too.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's actually, you know, like I normally I'm really conservative when it comes to stuff like that, but I think I did try it, and I said, oh, well, not bad.
It's all right. It's yeah. all right. But you know, I like. But you know, again, I like cherries, and I'm drinking a cherry beer right now. So you know, what there do I know?
There you go. You're an alt-right cherry supporter.
There you go. Wait a minute. What?
Did you just get done doing? Maybe I talked to Aaron Todd Douglas a couple months back. Maybe mid to late summer. Were you doing radio golf, August Wilson's?
Yes. Yes, I was. I was doing it with Aaron Todd's wife. She was in that, Andy. Uh-huh. And Ron OJ directed it here in Chicago at the Court Theater.
Oh, so you did it at the Court. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
How was that?
In fact, the only times I've worked at the Court are when Ron has been directing me. So, you know, when I'm going to work there again, I guess I got to look at the
black
next season's schedule and see what he's directing, because, you know, I don't really do anything else over there. And it was great, man. That was my first August Wilson.
That's what I was going to ask. That was the next question. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, I remember it was so crazy. Like the first, you know, cause August is like a proving ground, you know, like for any black actor, like, you know, at some point you know, you got to attack it. And, and it's kind of like a, you know, it's kind of a trite thing to say. And, you know, you could say measuring stick, and really you're measuring against your own, you know, how you know, your talent and, you know, the work you've put in, and, you know, but then you get a chance to do an August Wilson, and you get to see, like, you know, where your holes are, you know, because, you know, he doesn't, like, the way he writes is just so clear, so to the point that you can't, there's really no room for affectation, you know what I mean? And, you know, I remember we did the first, read through, and, you know, I'm always nervous before first rehearsals. Like, it's just one of those things, you know, and I can do a million shows, and it's like, I'll always be nervous that first, like, actually, I can tell you, it'd be first rehearsal, first preview, and opening night. Those are like, you know, forget about it. I'm a basket case.
Right.
But we did the first rehearsal, and, I remember going in there, and I'm seeing all these, like, you know, giants, you know, Alfred Wilson is there, and, you know, James T. Alfred, who's done a lot of August, you know, it was just kind of crazy. Like, I was like, man, I don't know how it's going to work, but I got to do it. And, so I jumped in and I did the read, and, you know, I basically acted out of the box, but not in a good way. Like, I gave what I thought the role was supposed to be.
Okay.
But it had no substance. It had no heft. It had no, really, it had no truth. And really that's what it's about. And I got through that read through, and I was like, man, I'm screwed. But then I thought, you know what? No, I just got to work. And it's written so well that if I, you know, give it the work that it deserves, you know, that any play deserves, but if I really, really work hard and let this character speak to me, you know, truthfully and, you know, tackle it that way, then the truth will come out. And really that's all it is, right? It's just about trying to tell a truthful story. And, and ultimately it did work out, but, man, it was a scary experience. I'm not going to lie, but one of the more rewarding experiences I've had. It seems like most of the stuff that I'm scared of, you know, those are the things that I end up, you know, once I've done them, I feel like, man, I'm so glad that I did that. I'm so glad that I jumped up and said, you know what? I just got to jump.
Well, I think that's the fun in it, right? Where it's just like the things that you're afraid of, you kind of have to see where that leads you and go down.
Yeah.
Because you'd have a sense of regret if you turned the roll down, probably.
Yeah. And I've done, you know, I've done a lot of those.
You've done Othello.
Like, yeah. But, you know, it's like that. I was scared as hell when that happened the very first time. You know, I was way too young when I did it, but very first time. Gosh, that was what, 2000? I think I was 30.
Okay.
I think I was 30. And I feel like that's just, you know, anybody can do a role at whatever age, but I feel like that role was one where I felt like the more I did it, the more I was like, man, I need one more shot. Cause I'm learning more, you know, I'm learning more about, the language and what certain scenes mean and what a character is going through versus what I think that character should be going through. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
I think we, you know, I feel like sometimes we try to fix, you know, perceived, you know, flaws in our character, I can't tell you how many times, like with that show in particular, that somebody came to me afterwards, like, man, come on, man, that dude, he's just not smart, man. Why would he be duped like that? Why would he, listen to this dude who's obviously, is just not a good dude. Like, why would he trust, you know, Iago, you know,
right.
And it's like, you know, so you find these ways where, you know, you have an answer for it, of course, but then you also are thinking, well, I don't know, does that affect, you know, should I make him smarter? Should I try and make him just try to make him ...
Sure.
As opposed to just saying, look, this is the character. This is what was written. It's a very complex character, and I have to find those levels and those parts and those places where his truth is and just be that and not try to fix him. And, I've done that in the past with different characters where I've been like, man, I don't know if I was this guy now, I don't know if I'd say that, or I don't know if I'd let that slide or whatever. And it's like, it's not me. It's the character. I have to, you know, you have to remember that.
And you can't judge. You can't judge the character.
You can't, exactly. That's a much more to the point way of saying what I've spent the last 5 minutes screwing around doing. But well, yeah, you can't judge him. No, but I mean, no, seriously, like you can't judge. You can't judge the character. You have to find its truth and go there, wherever that truth is for that character.
Well, I want you to touch on August Wilson a little bit more, because when I have black actors on, I like to talk about that a little bit. Now, what was the first time that you, when did you discover? Like, my listeners know that for me, it was like my sophomore year of college where, you know, I'd heard about Fences, but then I had found like Two Trains Running and Jitney, all that stuff. And that kind of opened my eyes, because before then it was just, you know, I'm doing Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff in junior high school. You're playing like white characters, you know,
right.
It's like colorblind casting and all that stuff. So when did it happen for you?
There was a play. I mean, I can't even remember, cause I'm not even gonna pretend that I'm, as they call it, a Wilsonian. Like I have so much to learn about his stuff and his plays, honestly. But I remember seeing, and I think it might have been Frankie Faison.
Okay.
He was doing, he was playing Memphis, not Memphis, God, what was he playing? It was over at the Signature in like 2006, maybe, in New York. Me and Alana and Monifa and Victor Cole and... we were all Libya Pugh. We were all New York doing
Chicago based.
Yeah, these are all Chicago based actors, like awesome actors. And yeah. We were doing Bluest Eye there, which was like
nice.
It started at Steppenwolf,
yeah.
But it ended up going to the Duke on 42nd, I guess.
Okay,
and we were only there for maybe 3 weeks, but while we were there, we got to see a lot of stuff, and man, I feel like it was either then or, man, maybe it was. Now, I know that trip I went, man, I'm going off on tangent. I know on that trip it was either that, man, or it might have been, man, I can't remember what it was. He was, anyway, Frankie Faison did it, did a show. And I just remember thinking, this is a really good piece of theater. And it's really like these characters are like, I don't know if I ever be able to do this kind of stuff. Because I remember thinking, they are so, so real. Like, yeah. So like you can't hide in the characters. Like you can't hide technique. Like you just have to tell the story. And I just remember thinking, man, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to do this stuff, but you know, it's not like anybody's casting me for it at the time.
Right,
so,
right, right. I know what you mean. Yeah.
So, you know, I wasn't really sweating it. I just kind of, you know, kept stepping, but I just remember thinking, you know, maybe one day I'll be able to have the, you know, the confidence to do it, or to give a director the confidence to trust me to do it, you know?
Sure.
But yeah, I just remember thinking, I don't know if I could do this.
Dude, I think about that all the time, man. It's like even like doing stand up where you see somebody that's just excellent, that just has a bit that's just really incredible, and you say, I'll never be able to, but you still keep going, you know?
Yeah, and you just kind of, you know, you kind of like with this rehearsal process with Radio Golf, you know, yeah. Like, you know, I these are actors who I very much respect. And so I was like, you know, and of course Ron. So I'm like, well, let me just lay in the cut, watch Alfred, watch Alan Gilmore, watch, you know, Annie, watch James T. Yeah. Just watch them do what they do. Just watch them live in it. And just listen to them talk, because, you know, James T will tell you some stories, and of course Alfred Wilson will, he's got like decades of, I think he's done like maybe 20, 25 of them. I don't know. He's done a lot of them. And of course Ron's done like 20, 25 of them. And, so just listen to these guys talk about it, and talk about, the stories and the history and the, you know, how, you know, it's all part of a series, but how all these characters show up in various places at various times, and, you know, or they're referred to, you know, Aunt Esther's house. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's just like, you know, I learned more by listening at rehearsals than I ever probably could have learned in college, like researching this, because these are guys who, you know, they've met him, they've worked with him, you know. I think Alfred had a relationship or knew of August. And I know that Ron knew him and talked to him on a number of occasions. And it's just like, you just kind of listen to the stories, and you try to soak up what you can. And I was really lucky to just be in such really great hands, you know, with this cast, with that show, because I ain't gonna lie, I was scared shitless, like just jumping in, but it was something that I was like, you know, it was like, you know, like Book of Mormon or something. Like, I was like, look, I know that I'm scared as hell of this, but I also know that if I really jump in, you know, I'll be really happy that I did it. Yeah. And I really was like, I just felt like as soon as I was done, when the show closed, I was like, man, okay, what's the next one I could do? What could I do? And I remember having a conversation with Alfred in the dressing room, because he knows all the place. I was like, man, what character? What do you see? What do you see? And he had ideas, and, you know, for different characters. And so I think my main thing now that I've finished my first one is I just got to become a student of his. Yeah. Of August, and just learn the plays and the characters and where they come in and where they go out and when they're referred to and the whole world of it, you know. And I think that's the next move for me before I try to tackle another one, and just keep my fingers crossed that that another director will take another shot at me.
Yeah, that's like, because you kind of have to. Cause like, you're no slouch either. You're a great actor, and you don't. I think we can always be in our heads about stuff,
sure,
as artists,
sure,
and just think like, oh God. But then they picked you, so you know, that, yeah. and they have some type of, and then you mentioned like all the names that you're working with, and I guess you kind of have to, it almost feels like you kind of have to get over yourself a little bit and just do the job too.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
I've been in your position before too, where it's just like, well, get over yourself. You got to do the job. They hired mm-hmm. you. So, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just got to get out of your own way. Quit navel gazing and just
yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like get in because you hope that a director, you know, if they've worked with you before, if they've seen in the audition room that, you know, that they trust your instincts, mm-hmm. you know, and that has to certainly be like one of the reasons that you're in the room, you know, that they trust your instincts.
Now, can you talk about that a little bit? Talk about, because every time I talk to actors, and I have like a lot of friends that like my comedian friends that act, and they ask me questions about it. Can you talk about the process of when you're auditioning for theater and what it's like when you're doing it for TV and film?
Man, that's a process. That's the question. Man, I don't know, man. I mean, you know, there's stuff that I think every actor probably does without labeling it.
Right.
You know, you know, you're trying to get as familiar with that, if it's a play, like with that playwright as you can, with, you know, again, like what I was talking about with August, like the work that they've done, you know, you're trying to, you know, I probably read a play maybe four or five times, you know, the week before we start rehearsal. And that's it. I mean, I'm reading it before that, but I mean, right. In that last little bit of time, I'm jumping in and I'm trying to answer as many questions that I have as possible. I'm always that dude who comes into the rehearsal room and I'm like, well, yeah, but what does he do for a living? You know? Yeah. And then someone's like, yeah, it's weird because your character literally says on page 39, I'm a welder, you know? And I'm like, so I'm always afraid of like being that dude who comes in and like, right. you know, asks that question that I should know, quote unquote. And
yeah.
And so I'm trying to find all the facts possible about my guy. And I'm trying right. to find, you know, all the stuff that you are when you're in a scene and all the stuff they teach you in school and your, you know, your objective and your super objective, you know, all that sure. stuff that they teach you.
Right.
And for me, I used to find myself doing this all the time. And I've tried to stray away from it now because I find myself doing more newer stuff than premiere stuff.
Okay.
than like classics last few years, I guess. And so it's been, I used to try and memorize and be basically like bedroom perfect when I came into rehearsal.
Yeah.
You know, like I could, if I was doing the lines in my bedroom, I could do it. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And I've, you know, there are a lot of people who are like, no, you can't do that because you're learning, you know, you're learning so much, you know, about your blocking and your motivations and your objectives and all this other stuff. And that's going to really be what helps you get your lines down. And I remember Ron saying in rehearsal at one point, he said, there's one lady he worked with who, you know, she was carrying around that book, like from the first rehearsal up through like
preview
tech,
damn,
like really through like tech. And then like last dress rehearsal, she would put that sucker down and it was all in. No line, no call for nothing, no anything. And so there are people who do that and they hold on as long as they can. Yeah. For me, it's kind of a security blanket. If I don't get off of it right away, I find myself in trouble. And so I've tried to be very familiar now is what I call it, rather than really memorizing per se. I just like to really come in very comfortable. Now, you know, as far as what the lines are and all that. So when I get in, for me, it's different because I want to, I want to get the book out of my hand as soon as I can so I can start like finding the spots, like where I move and when I move and what motivates me to move there and why, you know. And so for some people, it's the other way. For me, I guess I work backwards.
Yeah. Is it just because you get to play? I guess you just have to meld your process with your castmates. But when you're I always tell other people, like especially I guess maybe TV and film is, I would say it's the most, like I always say it's the most unartificial, the most artificial thing you do as a performer, because you can go and audition for a TV show or something, and the reader, you might not have a good reader, and you might not have, like, you might just be asked to go. Or if you're auditioning for a theater company for their season, if you do a classical and a contemporary piece, that's it. Like, you're just not, and it's just, you have to fill that space with whatever your reality is for that character. And it's just so, it can be so cold. And when you actually get to connect with somebody, it's like, oh, wow, we had a moment, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I guess, well, you know, I mean, you've done, like, TV stuff and, Kimmy Schmidt and things like that. So, I mean, like, you know, like, it's rare that you get, you know, theater, you rehearse. All you do is rehearse.
Yeah, right.
And then TV, it's like, you know, you're basically trying to memorize lines and cram them in and make them easy so that you're not really reaching for something, you know, unless it's kind of organically that the character would do. And you're kind of in your head space. And then suddenly you show up and there's these people who, you know, you've had like cardboard cutouts in your mind and now there they are.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, line. You know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, you could feel good as hell when you're like in your room, you know, or in your basement, like running stuff.
Yeah.
And man, I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me.
Oh
man, I've had so many, man, I could tell you stories, man, about
give me one.
Coming in and like, man, I got a million of them, but I'll tell you one. Okay. I remember doing several years ago, I did Chicago Code.
Okay.
You remember that show? It was like with Jennifer Beals was playing like a Chicago superintendent. I think Delroy Lindo was like a bad, alderman or something. I can't remember. Anyway, I remember I was called in. I auditioned for it. I did this like investigator thing, and I had one scene with these two dudes who were in the show, and it was cool. We did it. It was fine. There's another one. We're like running in on like some drug bust or something. You know, it's just like cop stuff. And then there was one that I did with Jennifer Beals, and I go in there, and you know, I've been rehearsing it. You know, I've been rehearsing. I mean, you can see what's coming.
Yeah.
So I'm rehearsing it in my head, and I'm like, oh, it's all good. It's all good. So I go in there, they're like, okay, are we ready? You know, slate, okay, sound, speed, you know, all that. Action. She's like, hey, you know, Detective so-and-so, good to see you again or whatever. And I was just like, Jennifer I was like Beals. Looking around the room, man. I was looking at the rug. Yeah, I was looking at the fake window with the fake sunlight. I was like, can we go back? You know, they're like, man. Oh yeah, cool. So let's do it. So, all right, sound, everything set, slate, everything ready. All right, action, you know, Detective so-and-so, it's good to see you again. Yeah. You know, I mean, just done. Damn. I did this like four times, Chris, four times.
What was wrong? What was wrong? Were you just in your head?
Well, yeah, because
of Jennifer Beals is hot,
you know. So, you know, I watch Flashdance.
Yeah, you know.
There's like, she's like working on she's welding, you know, she's, you know, she's dancing in the club. She, the scene, she takes her bra off and she's got her shirt on still. And, you know, you got all this stuff in your head.
Right.
And then
right.
you see her and you're like, well, that was so long ago. She's probably looks older and, you know, and there's, I don't know if you've seen her in person. Jennifer Beals is one of the most stunning women you will ever see.
Yeah.
See, like, in your life. My wife knows this. She knows how I felt about it. I'm not talking out of school.
Sure.
But I just couldn't figure it out. So bless their hearts. They're like, oh, there's something wrong with the, we got to change a battery or something, right? Mm-hmm. This is like one of the first scenes of the day, so I know that's bullshit, but whatever. So they got to change a battery. Why don't you guys run these lines real quick while we change the stuff? So I'm sitting here at this desk, and I'm running lines with Jennifer Beals. And, you know, we get through the scene like three times, and I'm like, yeah, I'm good. I'm ready to roll, you know. She's like, so let's do it one more time, and this time can you look at me? And I realized,
did she understand that she probably got the vibe that you probably were in love with her?
She probably did, but like, I felt like I was doing it, and then I realized I didn't even realize that I was looking down at the desk like the whole time, like, because I literally could not look at her.
Wow.
Anyway, so we ended up doing the scene, and if you look at it, man, that was so long ago, but if you find an episode of it, I think they maybe got me on like one coverage, but they couldn't keep it through the whole speech, the whole section, because I could barely get through it. So there were a lot of like wide angles, like, you know, from outside the room, from her coverage, like, you know, and then once in a while you'd see me in a reaction shot, but it was because I literally could barely speak. They might have gotten three clean takes out of like 15.
It's like a childhood crush. I have not done that yet. I mean, I've been like auditioned for stuff that it would have been an actress that I liked and had like a crush on. But yeah, I haven't. No, I've never done that. Never been there yet.
Nah, dude, it was jacked up. It was really like, it was one of those times where I just had to be like, come on, man, you know, person up, get it together, man, you know? And so now I've gotten better at that over the years, and I've done a few of these here and there. But I remember the same thing with Kelsey Grammer. I remember doing the scene with him for Boss and just being like, man, I'm in the room with Kelsey Grammer, man.
Yeah.
And he's one of those dudes that, like, you know, he'll be paying attention to everything else, right? Mm-hmm. Like his phone, talking to somebody, whatever, like not at all looking at his lines, like at all. And then they'll say, okay, ready and action. He'll just drill like a, you know, 12 line monologue, like just like it's nothing.
Damn.
But it's because, like, you know, he's been doing it for decades, but
sure.
But he's one of those guys. It's like, it's just in there, and it'll come out when he wants it to come out.
Sure.
I'm the one in the corner who's like running stuff and being all serious and like, no, you could do it, James, you could do it, you know, stuff like that.
My first SAG gig was, I think it was Kimmy Schmidt, and it was just that one I got cut out of, but I did an episode that'll be up next month. But there was just being in the dressing room with like Ellie Kemper, the lead. I was like, that was pretty neat. Like, you know, she was talking about her kid not getting any sleep or something. And like Tina Fey being in the same room, you like being in the same room with her. It's kind of a surreal thing. And the first, like, and I guess like after that, I did Can You Ever Forgive Me with Melissa McCarthy.
Right on.
Yeah. And I had a scene with her, and she said, hi, I'm Melissa, and I was like, I know who. In my head, I said, I know who you are. You know, it was just like one. It was very weird, and you just try not to mess anything up.
Man, good get on that, man. I didn't know you got work on that one.
Yeah, just came. It came out in October, like mid October, and they both
That's great.
Yeah, man, dude, it's.
And she just got a SAG nom, I thought.
She got a SAG nom. Her and Richard Grant got
SAG. That's great, man.
Yeah, my scene was with the two of them. I'm just glad, like, my listeners know and my family and friends know. I was just like, I'm just trying not to get cut. I hope I didn't get cut.
Yeah, that's true.
And a lot of people did get cut from what I heard from the casting director. But it was really cool to be in there. And it is one of those things where it's like, wow, I've been watching this person on TV for years. And yeah. now I'm doing a scene with them. And, you know,
yeah.
like I did an episode of The Last OG with Tiffany Haddish. And my scene was with her, and I played a Lyft driver. And I think, like, that was, like, I started getting, like, I just got my SAG card last year and doing stuff. That was the time where I had to get over myself, where I had to, oh, let's just have a little more fun with this. Because the director, he told me, he's like, yeah, Chris, I think you got the lines, and now just try to have a little more fun. Just, you know, let's see what we get. And then mm-hmm. I was like, oh, yeah, this is supposed to be fun. it's not about trying not to get fired. And, you know, right. it's just about you have to live and breathe in the moment. And then, like, I think when I was talking to Frankie Faison, I kind of came to the realization after about maybe 3 or 4 gigs, it was just like, oh, it's really not about you. Like, in TV and film, it's not about you at all.
Yeah. Yeah,
like they pick you because they like you, they think you're good and you can do the job. But past that, like they're worrying about lighting and are they going to make the day and
mm-hmm.
all this
mm-hmm.
other stuff. Where you just have to, when they say action, you just have to behave in front of the. You have to know your lines and say what you have to say.
True that.
Yeah,
true that.
That was like the revelation that I had, where it's just like, oh, this is okay. And I constantly say, like, this is, like, was a big, I guess, like, a revelation for me doing an episode of a TV show. I think it was Jessica Jones. And I just had, like, a little scene. And the director was like, okay, I think we got it. And I was like, okay, was that good? And she said, Chris, if I didn't like it, I'd tell you. And I was like, all right, that's, yeah, all right, okay, I guess I can go home.
Yeah.
We did it.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you though about how it started for you. Like where is Planet Krypton for you? Like I like to do origin stories and just kind of talk a little bit about how you got to this point and you know where did it? Are you from Chicago?
Yeah, I grew up in Evanston.
Okay.
Yeah, I grew up in Evanston, and so. You know, I what's funny is the very first show that I remember doing, like, besides, like, middle school, like, you know, with Mess Lefkowitz at King Lab up in Evanston, was Raisin in the Sun over at Northwestern. I was in seventh grade, and I played Travis.
Okay.
And I can't remember the dude's name, JJ something from, he was in a, he was the dad and smart guy.
Oh, shit. Oh, man.
You know what I'm talking about.
I'm going to look it up. I know who you're talking about.
JJ, I feel like, James. Anyway, he was Walter, and Harry Lennox was, was Bobo. And so I
really?
Fast forward. Yeah. Right. Wow. So this was a university, like we're talking like 1984.
John Marshall Jones.
Was that him?
Yeah.
And smart guy, yeah. So yeah. That was him. Yeah. So he was Walter and and Harry Lennox was Bobo. So okay. Fast forward to like 2000 and I did Raising the Sun again with Chuck Smith over at the old Goodman building before they left that old art institute in Chicago and moved further in downtown. And Harry Lennox was Walter. And I remember like being like, yeah, man, I don't know if you remember, you know, I was in seventh grade and such, and I was Travis, and he's like, yeah. And I was like, man, I don't think this dude remembers me.
Yeah, Harry was cool. But, like he directed King of Coons at Congress
yes,
Square.
Yes, which was one of my, and I know you understudied that.
I did, yeah.
And I remember Anthony Irons just
he murdered
man, him. Just broke my heart, man. Just broke my heart in that one. And that's probably one of the That's one of the best things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I was like, I never want to go on. I hope he never gets sick.
He was, I just remember thinking that show itself was like literally one of the best things I've seen, like probably top five, like theater experiences I've had. And I remember, and part of it was because of the show, and part of it was because, you know, I was there with, with my wife, with, my mother-in-law and her husband, my wife's stepdad, who's black. And he was like, look, I don't think I could do it. I don't think I could, bring myself to do that. You know what he did. And, I remember Ron OJ was in that audience and he said, well, you know, people do what they have to do. You know, this guy, you know, he was, of course, classically trained and, you know, the work was, he was so qualified for so much more than that. But Ron was like, look, you know, there's no way you can say, you know, what you would do or what you would not do. You know, it's kind of like when someone, you know, robs a lady in front of you or a guy in front of you and is coming up the stairs and is about to go by you, you know, you can always say, oh man, I'd stop that dude. Yeah. Really? You know what I mean? So you just don't know. And that play really broke that down for me. I just remember thinking, man, that the choices that he had to make, it was incredible, incredible.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, so man, how'd we get on Kia Coons?
We were talking about Harry.
Yeah, so yeah, he directed the hell out of that, but
yeah.
he had a killer actor in Anthony.
Yeah, that was such a great process for me to just be in that room at like 22, 23. And it was just like watching that. And that's like, I used his directing style to when I was working with the kids that I was teaching at theater camp in Skokie. Mm-hmm. Just like how, like, he would give you a note and he would give you a line reading, but he would, I don't really care about, I know some actors are like, give me a line reading, what do you do? But like, he wasn't a dick about it. He was like, what if it's this? What if you were thinking about this? And like, because definitely with kids, you kind of have to do that anyway when you're teaching them and stuff.
Sure.
But it was just sort of like, I would just watch him and it just kind of, I used that style when I was directing. And it helped me a lot. Just, you know, it was a great experience.
He killed it. So he was my first, like, you know, he was on stage, like the first show that I consider like my first, like, you know, the Krypton, I guess you call it.
So like 13
years. Yeah. I mean, yeah, whatever you are in like, what, seventh grade or so. And
yeah.
Yeah, that was a real trip, man. Just thinking back on that. And anyway, so. You know, I did that. I went to school at Piven Theater up in Evanston, Illinois, which is where, you know, like Byrne and Joyce Piven are kind of the late Byrne and then Joyce, the patriarchs and matriarch of kind of, I'd say like North Shore kind of theater. Like, I mean, they'd been around for like 30 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from there came, you know, Aidan Quinn and John Cusack and, you know, Leli Demos and, you know, all these guys. Yeah. So I studied there and I did a lot of improv stuff then, but it wasn't really like, you know, funny improv. It was more like just like unscripted, like telling a story improv, which was really cool to me because I never fancied myself as like a, you know, a comedic actor. And so it kind of gave us all room in the sandbox, so to speak. And so I did that and, you know, I went to school in Champaign, Illinois at U of I.
We're kind of skipping a little bit, but I want to get back to U of I. But like when you were a kid, was it just like 13 years old? Like, this is what I want to do. What were your?
I knew then because I felt what I still feel, which is like, you know, you rehearse with these people and you go in and you rehearse like day in, day out, and they become your family and they have, and you have to make this family fast, you know, and, you know, you're learning about, you know, what sets this person off, what to stay away from, when to speak up, you know? So you're kind of negotiating all of that in the rehearsal process. And, you know, people may say that, oh no, I just go in and I do the work, and people, you know, you still have to do that, yeah. You know, because you know, everybody's kind of, everybody to a degree has some nerves when they go into a rehearsal room. And of course, so, yeah. You know, man, what were we just talking about?
Just like the
that must have been that cherry ale I just had. It was pretty good, actually, Trader Joe's.
We were just talking about like the rehearsal process, and like when you were a kid, you were feeling the same thing.
Yeah,
that you
so
feel now.
Yeah, but so you know, in my mind, I'm like, damn, I hope he edits that out.
I don't really edit. No, it's fine. It's fine. It's totally.
You know what? Fuck it. Yeah. But I remember thinking, you know, this is what I want to do, because I made this family with these people, you know,
yeah,
with these guys. And now remember, I'm in seventh grade. So, you know, I'm dealing with these college people who are, they're around each other. They used to be around each other. I grieved when that show ended. I ran away from home.
Whoa.
Like the next day, not the next day, but probably the next week, because I was doing the show. And, you know, of course, you're letting you kind of let your grades slide a little bit, because, you know, you're going right over to Northwestern after school. Mm-hmm. And you're rehearsing with these college kids. And I probably had a crush on Benita. You know,
of course
your mind is
sure.
Right. So, you know, you're just thinking about
played Benita. I know you remember.
I'm trying to remember. I know who played her at Goodman. That was Takiya Christo-Kima, who is a stunning lady, as you know. And,
yeah.
But I just remember thinking, man, this is such a family. Like you get close to these people, and then and then the Monday happens after close, mm-hmm. and you go from seeing them every day to not seeing them at all, and it's heartbreaking, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling that acutely back then, mm-hmm. and feeling, you know, even the most recent show I did, even Radio Golf, like I remember feeling like, man, I'm really going to miss these people. I'm going to miss, you know, coming in every day and just like, you know, shooting the shit with these guys, you know.
A lot of people don't talk about that. And that I'm glad you brought that up, man,
because
that was definitely hard for me. And I remembered, I felt like even junior high school, even in college, where it's like, there were people like, because we had a drama club, and I minored in theater, and I got a communications degree, but I was always in the theater program. And then when the seniors would be leaving, and I'm like, what are you guys going to do? Are you going to do, you're going to act? No, I'm just going to run my father's business. And you're like, oh, and I never really found those people, my people, until I moved to Chicago. So that you got to think, like, I got into acting the same time as you did, at the same age, 13, 14.
Right.
And always, like, you lose those people and you're sad that you don't have that show anymore. And you constantly,
and I feel like
there's
like the idea that you will see these people again. Mm-hmm. I mean, you will. You see them at auditions. You'll see them, maybe you might be in a show with one of them again.
But it's not the same.
You're never going to have that group.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you're never going to have that particular group again. They will never act together again, unless, you know, you're lucky enough to do something, you know, at one of the bigger theaters, and they go, you know, to Broadway or something, and they want to take the cast as is, which rarely happens. But okay, so then maybe then you might get a chance to do it with them again. But the chances are very, very slim that you will ever work with that group again.
Right.
It just doesn't happen. And so, you know, you find yourself, you know, I remember back then I would kind of grieve for that. Mm-hmm. I would grieve for the loss of that group of people, you know, and for me, like, but I remember back then, you know, with Raisin in the Sun and doing that, I was like, well, I feel the grief of it, but I also feel like, this is it. Like, this is it. Like, I have to have that feeling of closeness again with another group, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, back then I think it was that I wasn't thinking so much about the work as much as, you know, the time spent in close proximity with these people and just being close, you know, being really cool with a group of people. And that relationship, that family, you know, it's, I don't think anyone outside of theater really, really knows what that is, as far as like really knows what we're talking about there. Mm-hmm. Because again, like, you're with these people for, like, you may rehearse, 4 weeks maybe, and then you do the show, and maybe the show runs as long as it runs, and then you go from nonstop seeing each other, except for Mondays, mm-hmm. every day of the week, to nothing. And that is that part of it is wonderful and heartbreaking.
Yeah. I was just texting with a friend who was directing a show. She's New York based, but she was directing a show in North Carolina, and she has like a corporate job. She works with the union. She works with Actors Equity, and I went to grad school with her, and she was just saying how, yeah, you know, I'm doing good. I directed a show in North Carolina, and I hated to come back to work, you know. And I was like, I know exactly how you feel. Even when I do like a TV show for a day or mm-hmm. two, it's just like, God, now I got to go, because I still have my day job. And it's just like, it's kind of a bummer. Like, you do something. Hell, I remember, so I did an episode of it. Well, we could probably talk about it off mic. But I did an episode of a TV show that's going to come out probably like next year sometime. Mm-hmm. And it was like this. It was black. And it was the first, like, really, like, all black cast that I worked with. And
wow.
And it was just like, it was a church scene. And we were six of us, mm-hmm. like, that had to carry this church scene. And when we were in rehearsal, we rehearsed it. I was like, God, this reminds me of just like doing a play. Like, it reminds me, it's just like, this is going to be great. And then it was a 16-hour shoot, and it was just gone like that. Like, the next day it was gone. And it was like you build these relationships, and it's just like, it's over. It'll live on in TV, but it was just, yeah. I just remember, like, that stuff is so, like, few and far between, and it's so, like, I guess what is ethereal the word, where it's just like, it's just kind of gone.
Yeah, it's I think that's the word.
I'll look it up later.
But yeah, but I know what you're talking about. I feel the same. But there was something about it that just made me think I got to do this.
Yeah.
And when I went down to school in Champaign at U of I,
Well, how were your parents?
Were they
cool with you doing the theater?
I think they were cool with it, but I think, you know, I look back now and I feel like you put a lot. You put a lot into your parents' mouths that they may not have said, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you know, that they may not have thought. Like, I remember thinking, man, I better major in like maybe English or pre-law or something. Cause you know, I want my parents to be happy with what I'm doing. And at least that'd be something that, you know, I could do well financially with and all this other stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I couldn't even tell you what pre-law was. I like English, you know, I like reading and all that stuff and English, different literature and stuff like that. But man, I didn't know what I was doing. But I thought that was what was going to make them happy. Now I look back and chances are they're probably going to be like, look, just do what's going to make you happy and keep you in school. And as it was, I went and did that and I dropped out inside of 2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because, you know, it just wasn't, you know, I think the bigger thing for me is I just don't think school was for me at that time, you know. But I remember thinking, man, I might as well have majored in theater, you know? And, you know, so you always put like perceived expectations on yourself, you know, instead of just doing what you do and doing what makes you happy and what gets you the degree. But I was still down there and I was still working a lot of, you know, community theater and like, you know, the station theater down there. And there was like this armory theater that did all this like crazy, like experimental stuff. And, you know, so I was, you know, I was fooling around down there, you know, even though I wasn't, you know, in the theater department, you know, I was doing plays with like, you know, the Black Student Union, and,
right.
You know, so I was getting around, but once I dropped out, I just kind of hung out down there, did more stuff at station theater. And then, came up in, fall of 94. And, I worked at a children's theater for like 3 years and, you know, it's just kind of, you know, I don't regret any of it because all of that kind of made me who I am today. But I remember, you know, I wasn't really keeping the blade sharp. You know what I mean? I was kind of, you know, the children's theater stuff was good because I was able to kind of harken back a little bit to the improv stuff that I did at Piven, which was good. But, you know, I didn't really feel like I was really, even though I was working with some great people, like awesome people. And one of them, like Janet Brooks, is like just a killer actor in town now, like incredible. But I just wasn't really extended. You know what I mean? And so when I got out of that, I think one of the first things I did was with Ron OJ. What did we do? An Onyx show in 98. We did East Texas Hot Links, I think, around that time.
Okay.
And I was, I think I understudied it. I was a very young dude. And, you know, I think I was understudying like Greg Holloman or, you know, somebody like that. And, you know, I just kind of like pieced it together, like bit by bit. My first union gig was that Raising the Sun. And, you know, with Harry playing Walter. And I remember thinking, man, this is going to be great. This is going to be awesome. Now I've joined the union. I'm making good money. Man, it's going to be great. Man, that's, you know, Goodman's like top of the mountain in Chicago.
Yes, definitely.
And so, you know, after that, my next gig or next two or three gigs were like, you know, tier in 110 per week after taxes.
Oh,
you know, so
what does that mean? Is that like
that's like, so you've got like Chicago contracts that are, it's a Chicago area theater contract, and it's like the CAT is what they call it.
Yes.
And it goes from like, you know, there's like tier six, which is like the big theaters. I think some of them do step downs, but like you know, Chicago Shakespeare and theaters like that. And then, you know, you go all the way down to the tier in, and that's literally the one where it's like, okay, we got like one equity contract. You know, it's basically a chance for us to be able to use equity actors when we really want them, but we really only got like one or two of them and they pay nothing. And it's, you know, so being union can vary greatly depending on, you know, the type of union work you're doing, where you're working. Yeah. And so I remember making like no money, like my first 2-3 years after I joined the union, and thinking, man, I don't know if this is going to work. And my wife was like, yeah, I don't know if this is going to work. Like, she was very supportive, of course, but you know, it had to be tough, you know, cause, yeah. You know, Chicago, what's good about Chicago is you can make a living, but you know, you got to hustle, you know, and,
definitely.
But you can make a living. And, I just kind of kept at it, Chris, you know, I just kept at it.
That's one of the things. I don't know how old you were when, well, I met you in 2002 and 2003, and I mm-hmm. told Todd, and I tell you that, like you and Todd were like the example for me, because it was like, oh, these are two black guys, and they're doing, right. they're acting, and they're working, and they're married, and they have a life, so it can happen, you know. Like,
yeah, in Chicago,
yeah, it was definitely like I look up to you guys. I still do, but you know, back then I looked, admired, and looked up to you guys because there was proof that you know, like right. living proof of actors doing it and black dudes doing it, you know.
And it was cool. He and I got a lot. That's I think when we met. And,
okay.
Doing Caesar, I think that's when we met, and it was just cool. I just felt really good that he was there. I'll put it like that, you know, I didn't know anybody there, and you know, they probably didn't know me. You know, yeah. What's this guy doing here? You know, so you know, and then for he and I to look up and see Kimberly. Oh, Hebert God, playing yes. Portia, you know,
oh,
like,
God, yeah.
We were like, well, hell, you know, shoot, she belongs, you know. And so, you know, if she can do it and she can, you know, she can get in and be incredible.
Yeah.
You know, what's to keep us from trying to hit this, you know? And I remember thinking, you know, I need to do something that allows me to find an angle that some other actors maybe don't have, you know? Yeah. And so for me, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to like lay in the cut over at Chicago Shakes. I'm going to play third soldier from the left for like four shows or whatever they can cast me in, mm-hmm. whatever I can get cast in. And I'm just going to soak it up. And I'm going to learn from, you know, people like Kim, learn from like the old dudes like, you know, Kevin Goodall and,
yeah.
and, you know, Greg Winkler and, you know, Scott Parkinson and all those guys who were right. just like, you know, killing it. And I just gotta sit back and listen, just like yeah. with Radio Golf. I just gotta sit back and soak up as much as I can.
And I gotta say, like, to the listeners, like, you're being really modest right now, but I mean, you're in the ensemble at Steppenwolf. One of the, I mean, I think they have more black actors in it now, but Steppenwolf, yeah. a prestigious theater company in Chicago, and you've done like some great stuff there. Can you just talk about that a little bit about Steppenwolf, and then I want to close with you with Widows, but let's talk about Steppenwolf a little bit.
Steppenwolf is one of those where I didn't even know that I was on their radar, you know, like, you know, I was doing, you know, I did The Bluest Eye with, you know, Alana Arenas, another brilliant Chicago actor,
yes.
based actor. And, you know, we did that in New York, and that was a Steppenwolf joint. And,
yeah.
And I remember doing, couple shows like around then, 2005, 2006 time, and one of them was Pain in the Itch, which is written by Bruce Norris, who wrote, you know, Clybourne Park and stuff like that, mm-hmm. And Downstate, like really, really, really good. And I remember, okay, I'm gonna do this audition. I'm probably not going to get it, but you know, I've auditioned for these guys like 18 million times and I haven't gotten anything, so whatever, you know, I'll just do it. And Anna Shapiro, Anna Barford now, was in the room. She was directing it, and I just remember her saying, what allowed me to cast you is you put nothing on, like you just spoke.
Yeah.
And it was like a real long monologue I think I had at the end. And and I remember going into that rehearsal room and again freaking out, like, you know, like I'm looking around and I'm seeing, like, first it's Steppenwolf. You know, I've always wanted to really be in rehearsing in the, you know, the highly regarded Jandorf rehearsal hall over there on North and Halstead. And here I am now, yeah. except now I got, you know, Marianne Mayberry, the late beautiful soul Marianne Mayberry, and, you know, Jane Houdyshell, New York actor, and Zach Orth, New York. And, you know, Kate Arrington, who joined when I joined, and Tracy Letts. And it was an incredible cast. Like,
right.
And I was just like, you know, crapping down my pant leg. Like, how is this going to work? You know what I mean? And, and somehow, you know, like you said earlier, you just got to say, look, it ain't about you, but just fucking do it, you know?
Yeah.
And I did. And after that, I, you know, I'd done one or two more things, and then they invited me into the office. I think it was January of 2007.
Okay.
Right after New Year's, I got an email from beautiful soul Martha Levy, and she said, "Come in." And I was like, "Anything I need to, you know, read or audition for?" And she's like, "Nothing to prepare." So I go in there, and they offered it to me. They offered me an ensemble, and you know, it was a really crazy kind of first year. I remember doing the Crucible there, and it was a crucible, you know, just kind of, you know, getting through it and the process, and then doing Carter's Way, which was a crucible, but in kind of different ways, you know. It was just it was a tough year, first year, but a you know, a professionally rewarding year. And you know, I've you know, it's an ensemble, but you know, there's like 50 of us.
Yeah. And what does that mean, like, for the listeners? You know? Kind of, what does that mean also for me, like, to be a part of that ensemble?
Well, that's the thing. It's like ensembles vary from company to company, and there's some ensembles where you're going to be a lot more hands-on as far as the work is concerned, and then there's some ensembles where, you know, they may say you're going to be a lot more hands-on, and maybe you are, and maybe you're not.
Right.
And you know, there's like, you know, 50 of you, and you know, there are some ensembles where they all vote, you know, like I think Looking Glass Theater in Chicago, they want to put a show up, you know, they do a read, and then the whole company votes, you know, they all vote, and it's got to pass.
Yeah.
And you know, Steppenwolf isn't like that. Like, they've got a group of people who, you know, they call the shots, and they that's all I'll say about it. Like, they call the shots.
Right,
and so
you know,
in theory, you can be as active as you want to be, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? So, you know, I've always told people, like, I'm more of the guy who's like, "Oh, you want me to do that? Cool. Oh, I got to..." You know,
yeah.
Or, "Oh, I gotta come up with an idea. Well, you know," so then I am in awe a bit. So I got no one to blame but myself as far as like being a bit more involved in it. I will say though that all the involvement in the world doesn't change the fact that it really comes down to like a few people who are determining that season.
Sure.
And so, you know, ensemble means different things to different companies.
Gotcha.
I'll put it that way.
Gotcha.
So that said, Steppenwolf has opened up many doors for me. I think there's a lot of people, whether it's camera or whether it's, you know, film or national tour, whatever, like where they can look and say, "Oh, he's a Steppenwolf guy. That must mean he's, you know, fill in the blank."
Sure.
And so they, you know, will jump or take the chance or whatever. So I don't regret at all having been invited into that office by Martha Levy and being, you know, effectively sponsored by Anna Barford to join that company, which is, you know, does incredible work, groundbreaking work, moving work. You know, I'm proud to be a member. But you know, ensemble is different for everybody, you know, depending on where you work. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about the thing that prompted me. Like, I, you were always on my radar to get you on. Like, I've had Kimberly's done the show, Todd, and now you make you round out
we've got the Julius Caesar trifecta.
Yes. The triumvirate of, Julius Caesar black actors.
Talk about a career. She is just doing her thing. I am so happy for her.
Yeah, she's killing it. Yeah. So like you were in Widows, the Steve McQueen flick. And I was like, "Oh shit, that's the notorious JVM." You know? Like I don't know. What talk about that process. Talk about getting maybe called in for the audition And then, like, what was that like? And then just being on set. Because you, I you were in arguably one of the, I guess, best scenes in a movie this year. One of the most interesting shots and sequences in a film this year.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah, no, that, yeah.
Talk about that process, like the process of like getting involved with this film.
Well, I'd never done a feature film before. Like I've done a lot of like kind of indie type stuff.
Okay.
But never like a feature film that like, you know, goes to the theater like, you know, a regular theater, you know, like, you know, not a viewing, you know. So
sure.
So, you know, I remember auditioning for it, and I auditioned for actually another role, kind of a more significant role that they ended up going with a name for. But I remember them saying, well, it's not because you didn't really do great work and they still want to use you. And I remember my agent saying they want to know if you'd be averse to being a kind of a driver. I was like, yeah, sure, you know, I don't care.
It's,
you know,
Steve McQueen.
Just Steve McQueen, chance to get out there and even rub shoulders with him for a minute, and
yeah,
you know, to at least to get some work on a film. And what's funny is the role that I didn't get only worked for like a day or two, even though it was more.
Which role more, was it? Which part?
It was the Reverend.
Oh, okay. With
yeah, so
is that John Hill?
John Michael Hill. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So,
yeah.
Who, you know, killed it, and then I looked at it and I was like, yeah, I can't really do that. So I'm glad they moved me over. But he got that. That's a good sized role.
That's
but
a good part.
You know, it's only like a couple of days of work. And
two
so
scenes. Yeah.
So I remember. Being like, damn, I really wanted that role, but I get it, you know, it's John, it's cool. And then they were like, well, you know, this guy, he doesn't really do much, but he's got, you know, like 2 or 3 weeks of work.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? Well, yeah, sign me up, you know. And so they cast me.
So you're,
I think
your
based
son,
on the
so
other,
basically your son's gonna have a good Christmas.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a whole other story.
Okay.
But I mean, you know how these things pay and when they pay and how they pay. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like, but I remember going in there, and I think the first day, I think we were at on the south side of Chicago at one of those beautiful, just gorgeous, you know, mansions that they have down in like Hyde Park, like Kenwood, like that area.
Okay.
Know? And I remember I just had to, I had a lot of times where I was like getting in and out of a car, or I was driving the car, or I had to like leave the house. And I said, I got to go to the garage or take the car to the garage or something like that. But I remember in the scene was like freaking Viola Davis was there. Right. And
yeah.
I'm like, doing my one line like time and time again, and she's like, you know, in that movie, like she's just like, you know, her character is like, I ain't even trying to even hear what you're, you know, like,
yeah.
She's very focused, you know, as
sure.
She I imagine always would be on a set, but in this movie for sure. And I just remember not even I could barely even talk to her. Like I think I had an opportunity to introduce myself, and I hemmed and hawed and said hello, and she was, you know, just smile and you just ting, like,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But I did that scene, and I remember McQueen like coming up to me a couple times and said, I just want, let's try it this way or that way. But he's very he was very easy to deal with. Like he was just a nice dude, you know. And
yeah.
He didn't really, I think he's one of those guys, like, and I guess a lot of directors, like even on TV, are like this. Like you have some directors who really direct you tight, and they direct you, you know, they really care about everything, you know, sometimes down to when you blink, and you know, so it's,
yeah.
You have those guys, but then you also have some directors who are like, yeah, I I want my guys to, these are the people I hired, these are the people I cast, and I did it because they know what the hell they're doing.
Right.
And it wasn't like I had a whole lot of lifting to do in that movie. I mean, I'm like driving around, I'm picking up something, I'm Colin Farrell's bag man, basically.
Yeah.
And, he kind of trusted me to just kind of do things and to fool around and to try different takes of stuff. And, mm-hmm. and when I went a little too far over, then he'd, gently guide me back. But,
yeah.
Just a gem of a guy. And the experience was, it was crazy. And going back to that scene you were talking
about.
Yeah,
let's talk about that scene.
So what's crazy about it is...
Explain it. Explain it to the listeners.
You've got a scene where, Colin Farrell is leaving a speech. He's kind of doing a speech on like a corner, pick your glass bottled open lot, on the south side, like you've got like a tent up and you got some people who are like local community members and, he's trying to tell them what he's going to do when he's their alderman and, when he gets elected. After they leave, he leaves with his assistant and I get them into the car, the town car, and then we pull off and we leave this like really kind of broken down lot, like in the middle, like 47th, but like one of those, in Chicago, like one of those lots that's just like, it sparkles from above because it's just a bunch of broken beer bottles and glass, and it's that area, like, it's definitely been on the come up, but there's still blocks that are like that
blighted areas and stuff.
Yeah. So the car moves and the camera is basically on the top of the kind of the roof of the car, but leaning out in front of the window, and it's kind of reflecting the neighborhood as you drive. And so you see a little bit of me driving on occasion, and you hear this conversation in the back of, Colin Farrell, talking about, just being pissed off about this, that, and the other. And he's talking like all kinds of stuff. Like, I think one of his lines to his assistant is, have you ever fucked a black guy? And he doesn't really care
that you're there,
that I'm in the car. Like, I'm the scenery basically. And also chances are he pays me well enough that, I'm not going to say shit, he's doing all this stuff. And so it's kind of a cool scene because you see, you're listening to that aspect of it, mm-hmm. and then you almost forget to look at the window that is reflecting the neighborhoods as they go by. And you see Chicago is very much like this, where you go from like a wide open lot with a lot like a blighted area, mm-hmm. And you drive literally 5 minutes. I mean, seriously, like not even 5 minutes, might be less than that. And by the end of the scene, you're on a block that is filled with these mansions, and they're mm-hmm. big mansions. They're like, we're talking like 6,000 square foot, 8,000 square foot. They all have carriage houses. They all have drives. They all are gated. And it happened literally in the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. And so you see how close the haves are to the have nots, in this, and certainly in Chicago, very much so. And so, the interesting thing about the scene is I remember we were dealing with a lot of rain and we were going to do the scene. And I don't know if we ended up doing it on this day, but it had been raining. And I remember at one point me and Colin Farrell were like sitting in the town car waiting for the rain to pass. And, if you're on a set, this rain may seem to be done. And then you see like way in the distance, like miles away, you see a lightning, And then you're like, well, okay, we got to wait because I can't remember the rule, but it's something like you need like a half hour of lightning free sky in order to shoot. Oh. And so we couldn't really, we couldn't shoot. Like we were just kind of sitting there, and, Colin Farrell, really nice guy, by the way.
Cool.
But I remember, when we finally did the scene, they filmed it a number of different ways. But the only one that they kept was this shot, which was above the car. And it was genius. It was like one of those things that only from the mind of McQueen, you know, like no one would even imagine that being the perfect shot. But it wasn't just the perfect shot for that scene. It was the perfect shot for that area. It was the perfect shot for what he probably saw when he drove around that neighborhood.
Yeah.
He saw that there was like blighted areas, literally 2 blocks away, 3 blocks away from, you know, $3 million, $4 million mansions. I mean, Muhammad Ali had a mansion down over there. You know what I mean? It's the haves and the have nots in that part of town. It's just amazing how stunningly close they are to each other.
It's basically, that's what that whole movie was about, that scene. And it was interesting where I think like the black filmmakers this year, like the top movies, like with Black Klansmen, Widows, and Beale Street, it was just like there were movies that on the surface they were about one thing, but then they were about, it was about so much more, especially with Widows, where I think most people like this, oh, it wasn't what I expected. You expect it to be a heist movie, but it is, but then it's you got that popcorn thriller aspect of it. But then it's also a meditation on race, class, social stratification, like corrupt government. And it was really rounded out really well. Like it was just about a lot of different things. And these women are going to pull off a heist.
And you see like the side of Chicago that you know, with all due respect to, you know, like the one Chicago shows, you know, Chicago Fire, PD, Med, which are, you know, great shows. Don't get me wrong. I've worked in that world and they're really great people who work on those shows.
Sure.
But the side of Chicago that you see on Widows is very different. Like it's not, you know, this person going to this Linkin Park house or this, you know, walk up or whatever. It's like, it's how these neighborhoods literally sit right next to each other.
Yeah.
Like, and how you can literally walk a block, you know, or two. Like Baltimore has that aspect of it to a degree, you know?
Yeah.
But like, you know, Chicago, like how you can literally walk, like, and you can, like, I remember doing that show down at the Court Theater, which is down in Hyde Park.
Oh,
and one day in between shows, we all just kind of went on a walk and we walked through, you know, Hyde Park, and we walked over in Kenwood area, and we walked by, you know, President Obama's, you know, Chicago home, you know, and, you know, and then you can walk all the way up to 47th, and then, you know, it's different, but then you also got like, you know, I think there's a Mariano's and like, there's like different things that are on the come up on 47th. And it's like, you know, you just have, all of these neighborhoods that are like of varying incomes and stratas, like literally right next to each other, you know? And you see that, I mean, you know, Chicago is filled with areas like that, you know, Beverly and Oak Lawn. And, you know, I mean, you just don't know, like, you can literally walk in like with like you said, a blighted area, and then you walk like 3 blocks and you're like, how did I get here?
There's like a white woman jogging.
Yeah,
dude,
first
time, I think maybe like my first or second year there, speaking of Raisin in the Sun, I was in this bad production of it, like somewhere like in the Ida B. Wells projects. And it was supposed to be on the west side, but then it was down there. It was really weird. And the director took me. I was like, oh, let's go to White Castle. I had never been to a White Castle at the time. And she was like, yeah, well, this is kind of the hood. And then a couple blocks away, we saw like a white woman walking her dog, and it was safe. And I was like, wow, that's crazy. It was just so crazy to me how segregated that it is, and people continue to, you know, say it is. And like, you kind of think like, oh god, I guess has it changed,
man?
In your opinion,
I think Chicago I mean, I'm not, you know, breaking any new ground here when I say that Chicago to me is the most segregated city in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it is, and I don't think that that has really changed much. I think that there's a lot of, there are certain parts of Chicago land where, you know, where the haves, you know, maybe they're moving further from downtown, you know, and so they're moving out to, you know, but they want to get the house, they want the dream, but you know, they maybe they can't afford to live up in, you know, Winnetka or wherever, but maybe they can live in like, oh, there's these great little houses in Evanston that are really reasonable. Well, you know, those houses are like in black neighborhoods. And so like, you know, like my grandmother lived on Emerson in Evanston and, you know, like near the canal, you know, way away from the lake. And, you know, then it freaked me out once I found out that there was like a white family that like moved basically next to her, were like, you know, this old black couple that I knew for decades lived, you know, and it's just like so there is I wouldn't even call it, in some areas I don't even know if you call it gentrification as much as you call it like people are like, you know, oh wait, you mean I can live in this city for and only pay this much and the taxes are this reasonable? Well, you know, fuck it, I'll be a quote unquote pioneer. You know what I mean? And so you're seeing, so you're starting to see, you know, a lot more of that in like the near suburbs, you know, and even like the near South Side, like, you know, by IIT and places like that. Now they got these like, you know, really nice townhomes that are up down there. And, you know, it's, you know, Chicago is changing, but it's kind of like, it's still there, man. I mean, I live in Oak Park. And,
that's,
you know,
like on the west side, the west.
Yeah.
Up the Green Line, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, what, you know, Oak Park is very, you know, quote unquote, you know, what, diverse, but, you know, and I could go into it. It's just like all these things change, but they don't.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like things change on the surface, but now there's a different way that it's being done.
Gotcha.
You know, so you know, I think Chicago is very much like that, and how, you know, but really the idea, like going back to Widows, like the idea that these, you know, the haves, like, and it's not like moderately haves, like haves, like really haves, like those that, you know, they're literally right down the street.
Yeah.
Like, you know, from like these blighted areas. And it's like, I don't understand. It's not for me to understand. I can't figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, well, you were a part of them showing that shit. Cause that was great. Like, cause I was like, damn, they really broke that shit. I'm going to get it on Blu-ray, but yeah, they really, yeah, it was good. Like it was,
and just, I think that's part of what, you know, Chicago was shown, that like, you know, I think people who are, it's a shame that the film has not, done as good as perhaps they may have hoped that it would do, because, it is literally like, you know, people say something's a love letter to a city or something like that. It's not a love letter to Chicago. It's literally like giving you much more of, much more insight into what Chicago really looks like. And it's not, you know, the weird fake addresses on these series, like, you know, 2500 East Randolph.
Yeah. Right.
Like the middle of the lake. And everybody in Chicago knows that. And so that was a cool thing that I remember about Willows. Like Widows. I don't remember them giving those weird fake addresses out. Like I felt like they were really in the world of Chicago. Like it was, as much as they could be.
I think, I mean, a nerd like me was excited to see it. Like, I mean, there were quite a few. I saw it on a Friday when I didn't go to work, and it was like, because it was the day after an insane snowstorm, and I was like, I got home like late. I was like, I'm not going to work, and I saw where they basically closed all the movie theaters down in the area Because I got stuck in the snow, and I was like, oh, I guess maybe I'll go see Widows at the mall. I'll go see the Thursday opening, and the movies were shut down. And I was like, oh, I'm not going tomorrow. I'm not going to work. I'll see it. It was quite a few people in the theater for like a 10:30 screening. And I was like, man, this shit, like, it's a good movie. I don't know what, I think maybe just people were thinking that the heist was supposed to be, maybe that's the selling point for mainstream America, but I was pleasantly surprised that it was more than just a heist film, you know?
Another thing that I loved about it, like, just on a selfish level, like, as a Chicago actor, like, there were a ton of us who were in this movie, and it just, to me, spoke to McQueen's, like, desire to get, like, the right people in, like,
right,
you know, to not, like, you know, bring people from LA or from New York, like, to really actually get Chicago actors who are, you know, killer actors, and you put them up against anybody, and you know, every scene I felt like I was watching somebody. I was like, oh, he's in it too, or oh, he's in it too, and I just remember loving that, and just going to the first viewing here in Chicago. That was, I think it was the day before it was the day, you know, before the night that it actually, you know, premiered, and all the big stars and everybody was at, you know, the Chicago Film Festival.
Sure.
But that one during the day was like kind of just for us. It was just for, like, you know, the people in Chicago who either worked on it, like the incredible crew that, you know, you see on all these different series who are all locals who worked on it, or, you know, the actors who were a part of it. And just the pride that was in that room, you know, in that theater when that movie finished, and just feeling like we all saw Chicago represented truthfully. You know, it was really, really cool.
Well, I always say that, like, there's part of me that still considers myself to be a Chicago actor, because that's where I trained. And every time I see, like, someone like you on screen, like, it's always like you see somebody that you know in something that's like a fucking monster, but it's like you're just driving the dude around. And even though it's like, you know, like, these people have the potential to do so much more, but it's just like, hey, he's working. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like that, but it's like, it's like, y'all don't know. Like, I talk to, like, Scott Stanglin all the time. Like, you know Scott, right?
Yeah, who was killing it opposite my good Book of Mormon castmate, Danae Benton.
Yes.
He was in The Comet. Yeah, 1812, I think.
Great Comet, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you see these people they book a part on a TV show. And it's like, it's like, good for them, but yo, like, that guy, that girl is a fucking beast, and it's like they're just like saying four lines on a TV show. It's just so much talent.
That's how I felt watching. I was like, man, y'all lucky y'all got her. Y'all lucky y'all got him.
Because
these are all like heavy hitters in Chicago, like killers.
Well, where do you just finished working on a show recently? You were telling me.
Oh, I was filming something that it'll come out.
You can't talk
series.
About it.
Yeah. No, well, I'm not. I'm not saying anything or giving anything away.
Okay.
It's a new series that's going to be out on NBC, I think, in the early spring, and that was like a great experience, really cool, and I work with some great actors on that, and one cool thing about this, you know, the one Chicago thing, you know, in Chicago, Dick Wolf and all that.
Yeah.
They got, like, people to realize that, you know, Chicago is already, it's not like we just got a bunch of good actors, but we just got a bunch of really good crew people who can, like, carry these shows.
Right.
Like, these people have always been there. And now, you know, Chicago Med, PD, Fire, all these other shows that's kind of come through in the recent, you know, in recent years, like,
that's great.
It's like they realize that, you know, we can hold it, you know, we can hold down a number of shows here. We have the talent, you know, in front of and behind the camera. And, it's, it's, it's kind of shocking that it's taken people that long to realize that about Chicago. You know, yeah. it's not like we're Shabance or, you know, Rantoul or something. I mean, you know, it's a big city. You know, we got a lot of like people who can do the work, and not casting aspersions on Rantoul or Shabance, Illinois.
I've never even heard of those towns. Where are those? Are they in Illinois?
Southern Illinois. Well, you know, when you, I know Rantoul, like if you go to school down in Champaign, like, you know, okay. You know, all those small, you know, LaSalle, Peru, and, you know, Rossville, and, you know, all those small Kankakee, and, you know, all these little smaller. But, you know, it's just good to know that the light is being shined. And so, like, this thing that I just did is like another good show that I hope sticks, that I hope, really does stick to Chicago, because, you know, I just feel like it's good work that I did, and that these Chicago actors are doing, and that we're finally getting on these shows, and we're not just, you know, day players,
right?
You know,
right,
like
right.
we're actually characters who affect a plot of a show, and it's really good to be thought of that way by the, you know, the powers that be on the coasts.
And it should be, because it's so much talent there. And you would be fooling yourself, because when I left in 07, and there was nothing.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything really. And I guess I started seeing it maybe when The Dark Knight came out in 07, 08, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I started to see people that I'd worked with on those films. I'm like, oh, I know that guy. I know this person. I was like, okay.
You know? Yeah, it's a really, really great time for actors here. It's, you know, the unfortunate thing is, like, you know, if you're, you know, you get into like one of those worlds, like the one Chicago shows, you know, you, once you're done, like, you're burned. So like you can't, it's not like you can just jump back in as, you know, a lawyer or as a judge or as a, you know, a cop or whatever. It's like it's like your shot is burned for like a couple of years. And so you kind of have to like cool your jets and kind of wait for the next, you know, because they've seen you. And it's like, it's all one world, you know, those Dick Wolf shows. So you kind of have to hope you got on a good horse and ride it, and then, wait a couple of years
and then get some regional theater work.
Get some regional theater work. Yes, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, James, this has been great, man. It's been great to talk to you.
Man, of course. You're going to have to edit this down, man. I talked your ear off.
No, we won't. No, it's only like an hour and a half. That's good. This is great, man. Well, hold on to the line, and we'll just wrap it up.
You got it.
So, James, thanks so much for doing this pod. I appreciate you.
No worries, man. I'm glad that you thought of me.
Yeah, man. No doubt. Everybody, take it easy. I'll talk to you next time. Easy.